history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there still are heroic stories to be told, and often they're hidden in plain sight. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take this journey together each time, we learn a lot. Yes, we're educated, we're entertained. Ultimately, we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If we're open to it, these memories can have an impact on our latest generations. Typically, we spend most of our time discussing things that happened more than 70 years ago. But today, we're going to start with something that happened just this week. You may have heard the news. The aircraft carrier USS Lexington was discovered this week 2 miles deep on the floor of the Coral Sea, nearly 76 years after that historic ship was sunk during World War II. You may recall that 6 months ago, the USS Indianapolis was discovered by the research vessel Petrel, funded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. His father served in World War II, and Allen has devoted much effort and expense toward preserving military history through several different avenues. Finding the Indianapolis was kind of a needle in a haystack, and in the case of the Lexington, the Navy knew where she went down on May 8th of 1942, and she went way, way, way down, 2 miles deep, where that discovery was made this week. As soon as I heard the news, my thoughts turned to Gordon Scott, a survivor of the Lexington who shared his story on this program about 4 years ago. Gordon, who grew up in Kingsburg, California, and spent some of his later years on the Monterey Peninsula, where he was instrumental in founding the famed Poppy Hills Golf Course 3 decades ago, resides now at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, where I had the privilege of being the first to show him the video and still images of the Lexington and his ship's final resting place. We'll get more of Gordon's World War II experiences on the Lexington in a moment, but the first thing I had to ask was, did it ever occur to him over the last 3/4 of a century since he abandoned that sinking ship that the wreckage of the Lexington might ever be found?
No, it's unbelievable. The Navy knew at the proximity of where the ship was sunk, but it's still unbelievable to find it.
And they went to great expense and great effort to find that ship, to see those images from 2 miles deep in the Coral Sea, to see the guns and the airplanes. And what does that bring to mind for you?
Well, when I heard the news, I absolutely couldn't believe it. This Paul Allen that's funded this deal for doing this is unbelievable. I don't know about the Indianapolis, but that has to be even more remarkable to find it than the Lexington was. But we started at 11-something in the morning, never abandoned ship till 5:18 that evening, and we're down. Some guys got lucky and got right on board another ship. Others were picked up by different destroyers and transferred to cruisers. It's been a long time ago.
Can you help us understand the feeling you get or the emotion of looking at that video or those photos and seeing that name, Lexington, inscribed on the metal 2 miles deep?
No, I just can't. It's just unbelievable that they were able to do this. And most of the memories you forgot, but this brings back a lot of them. And I'd like to thank you, Paul, for bringing this and showing me the pictures of this. It's just unbelievable.
I imagine there'll probably be more to come as they continue to explore that area with the greatest respect for those who are still on the ship. And I know you're here. You're one of the survivors. You had a crew of close to 2,800 on that ship, and there were a little more than 200 who died. But do you think this holds significance for those families of those who died? And just for you as someone who may have known some of those gentlemen who died, do you think this is a way to honor them to have found this wreck and have an idea of where their final resting place is?
Well, it probably means more to their families than it does to the individuals. I'll be 96 in just a few months, and so there isn't very many left of us. In fact, I really don't know who's left, but it has to mean a lot to the families to see this and remember this.
Well, and it gives people an excuse to talk about your ship again, and your ship was significant in World War II. And I know we've talked about this before. We put a whole hour on the radio about it. But when you think about the Lexington and its legacy or its significance,
What comes to mind for you?
This happens to be a deal I had written down here. The Lex was at sea 113 days since December the 7th until it was sunk. They had 4,900 landings between December the 7th and May the 8th and traveled 43,311 miles between December 7th and the 8th. Total crew was 2,934. This is just a few of the deals that I've written down in the past. The Battle of Bougainville was February the 20th, 1942. Was the first battle for the Lexington and the fighter group. Then they went to Salamalua. Now it's unbelievable. May the 8th, 1942. Abandoned ship at 5:18 that evening.
Is it hard at all? Is it difficult to look at those images?
No, it isn't. Brings back a lot of memories, but it's not difficult to watch them. And it's just unbelievable that they were able to do this. And I'm sure, like I said, it means a lot to the families because most of the people are gone.
Most of the 2,770 who survived the Lexington sinking are gone, and their families have been moved by this discovery. That includes the man commanding the entire U.S. Pacific Command, Admiral Harry B. Harris, Jr. As the son of a survivor of the USS Lexington, Admiral Harris said this week, I offer my congratulations to Paul Allen and the expedition crew of Research Vessel Petrel for locating the Lady Lex sunk nearly 76 years ago at the Battle of Coral Sea. We honor the valor and sacrifice of the Lady Lex's sailors, all those Americans who fought in World War II, by continuing to secure the freedoms they won for all of us. Well, he knows how to say it. I haven't heard a speech yet that Admiral Harris didn't nail. And the reality is, the man who commands all of our American forces in the Pacific would have never been born if his father hadn't survived the sinking of that carrier. And we have a dwindling number of sailors who can tell the Lexington story, so let's hear about it through the memories of Gordon Scott. He enlisted in the Navy on his 18th birthday in July 1940, having no idea that America would be at war a year and a half later.
No, I didn't. When I first got in the Navy, I went to San Diego Naval Training Station and was there in training program for 3 months. For a while, I thought I might have been in the Army. We'd done so much drilling. But they do teach you a lot of things, and not only drilling and marching and various things like that, but they had various schools like firefighting school, and I didn't realize how important the firefighting school was for the Navy. Our ship eventually burned up. So it was quite a deal there.
What was your first impression of the Lexington? When did you go aboard that ship?
When I got through after 3 months in Naval Training Station San Diego, was sent to Long Beach and got on a destroyer and sent to Long Beach and was stationed on the USS Arizona. I left from Long Beach and went to Bremerton, Washington Naval Shipyard there. And the Lexington was in there, and after about a month on the USS Arizona, I was transferred to the Lexington, which was very fortunate from what happened to the Arizona.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, whoa, I've heard of that ship. Maybe I've visited what's left of that ship as it still sits there in Pearl Harbor with those teardrops of oil bubbling to the surface. Did you know a lot of those who are still on the Arizona?
Well, I didn't know that many. After all, I was only aboard Arizona for about a month. But then I went on the Lexington. I did get to know a few people, and I've never found out what's happened to him. But the Lexington, I got aboard the Lexington and was stationed in what they call V1 Division, which had the after flight deck deal on the carrier. We were there for about a month and left from there and went back to Long Beach. And from there we went from Long Beach to Pearl Harbor.
And this is all still before anything has happened war-wise. America is not at war. Were there any rumblings that you guys were preparing for something like that?
No, we had done nothing but training was in and out of Pearl Harbor and flight quarters and training both our crew and the pilots too. We didn't hear anything about war till the national emergency started. There when we'd go to sea, even after before we were in the war, we'd go to sea and it was just blackout at night and the lights and everything. So they were looking for something, but we really didn't know about anything.
And we've heard a lot over the years about December 7th and what Pearl Harbor was like that day from different vantage points. Maybe you can give us a sense of what it was like around there before all this happened. Was it almost like an adventure for you to be out in that part of the world?
At that time, you didn't realize it was quite a resort deal like it is today. But and we were away from home, so It wasn't as luxurious as we thought it might be, but it is a great place.
And I mentioned that date, December 7th, and you might have been there December 7th, but the Lexington shipped out the day before?
Yes, we were anchored just on the left side of Ford Island, which is a Naval Air Station in Pearl Harbor. And we left out on our way to Midway with a load of Marine planes to reinforce Midway. When we heard about the war, or they bombed Pearl Harbor, we turned around and tried to intercept them, and we couldn't find them, and probably very lucky we didn't, because we didn't have a big fleet with us. The original Lexington had 5-inch guns, 4 batteries of 5-inch guns, and 4 turrets. It had originally been built for a battle cruiser. Right after the war started, we went back into the naval shipyard there and took the turrets off and got rid of the 5-inch guns, and they put all in anti-aircraft guns, because that was what it's going to be all about, fighting planes.
And you mentioned when the war started, but I imagine that's a pretty significant memory for you, how you found out you're aboard the Lexington and you just left Pearl Harbor yesterday and now they're bombing Pearl Harbor. How did that news come to your ship?
Well, of course, it was transmitted by radio to the ship, and they announced it on the loudspeaker and sounded general quarters. From there, they had bringing up all the ammunition and everything for all the gun turrets and the 5-inch guns and whatever. We tried to find the Japanese fleet, but it was very fortunate we didn't, because they probably could have blown us out of the water. So we steamed around and never did find where they came from or anything, and we turned around after 3 or 4 days, came back into Pearl Harbor, and it was just, we just couldn't believe it. The USS Utah, which is an old battleship that had retired and they were just using it for training purposes, had taken our berth on Ford Island, and you don't hear anything about the USS Utah, but it's still underwater alongside Ford Island right now. They literally blew it up and had thought that we would be there. They knew every ship that was there. The only mistake I think the Japanese made, right above at the Pearl City there, up on the hill was Red Hill. All of the fuel for all of the ships and everything were in big tanks there. If they'd have bombed those, we would have had to come clear back to the mainland United States. They didn't touch him. That was a big mistake they made.
Yeah, and a big what if. And you've got a few of those. What if you had remained on the Arizona? You wouldn't be here. And as you said, the Utah, which along with the Arizona, the Oklahoma, was taken out that day, it was in your spot. So that's another what if you had still been there?
That's right. Yeah, couldn't believe it. The Utah is still underwater there. They never have done anything about it.
And I want to discuss a little more of that scene that you saw when you sailed back into Pearl, but you mentioned going to general quarters on your ship, the Lexington. What did that mean for you personally? What was your duty station at that point?
We were up on the flight deck, and of course, we didn't launch any planes. We were scouting around trying to find the Japanese fleet, too. And we had search planes up, landed them back aboard, but we just couldn't believe it.
And when you did roll back into Pearl, and you mentioned the Utah being in your spot, but most of us weren't there, and maybe we've seen some grainy film or we've seen some black and white photos, but you saw it in living color that day. What did you see, and what did it do to you?
We just couldn't believe it. It was almost sick. Oil on the water and the ships, they weren't burning then, but, I mean, sunk. The battleship, there's what we call Battleship Row on one side of the island, was the opposite side where the carriers used to anchor, which was very, very fortunate. The whole time I was in there, from when I first got to Hawaii in Pearl Harbor, I don't believe I ever seen that there wasn't a carrier in port. And it's really amazing that the Saratoga at that point was back in the mainland in the United States. And I keep referring to the United States because Hawaii wasn't in the United States at that time. It just was unbelievable to see the destruction. The ships underwater and everything, and I forget how long it took. We refueled, reprovisioned, and we left out of there, and we never came back 90 days at sea without touching port, and we never did find the Japanese.
Well, you guys would have a pretty impressive encounter with them in late February, but I want to get a taste for what it was like aboard the Lexington, because we've maybe seen the posters with the tattered flag and Remember Pearl Harbor, or we've seen, of course, the legendary song Remember Pearl Harbor. But is it too melodramatic to say that was a rallying cry aboard your ship? What was the impact on morale, on motivation, on what that did for you guys to have seen that devastation and to know that now your country is at war?
First of all, it was hard to believe. Even though we had been training for war, really, and all the time prior to December the 7th, we'd be in and out of Pearl Harbor. We'd alternate with ships. Between the three main deals, the Enterprise and the Yorktown and the Lexington, there was always someone in port. It wasn't a coincidence that no ship or carriers were in there. All the battleships were. But it was just kind of hard for us to believe. And the devastation was just unbelievable.
How did that leave you guys feeling about the future or about the Japanese or about the task that you had at hand now?
We knew that's what we were there for. We were all over the Pacific trying to find the Japanese fleet or whatever, maybe trying to make them think we had more than we did, but I'm sure that they knew we didn't have more. Then on February the 20th, we were going to try to make a strike on the Japanese in Rabaul. And Rabaul is quite a bit above the Guadalcanal, east side of Guadalcanal, further up in there. And we were going in there and try to bomb them in Rabaul. On the 20th, they spotted us, or one of their planes spotted us. There was nine Mitsubishi 97, which is called Bettys, that came out and attacked us. They got to the dropping point, and the captain of the ship had somebody with binoculars, and was supposed to let them know when they seen the bombs drop. And he swung the ship around, and it just thudded around the stern of the ship and missed the ship.
Where were you while that was going on? What were you supposed to be doing?
Well, at that point, we'd launched our planes, and we were waiting for some of our planes to come back in. Like I said, we had charge of the resting gear in the after part of the ship. This is the barrier cables and cross-deck pennants that go across the ship that the planes catch with the hook of their deal and stop the planes from crashing. So we were just waiting for our planes to come back, and our planes then were chasing the first wave of nine. When they were chasing them, here come another wave of nine, and we had Lieutenant Butch O'Hara and another fellow that was in above the ship. The other fellow's guns jammed, and when they were chasing these planes away, that was a wave of nine, and he shot five of those down. We turned around and got out of there because we were up, and Rabaul was quite deep in Japanese territory at that time.
I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be you. So your job is, when these planes are going to land, to make sure that tail hook catches the cable and they don't go careening off the deck. But it's probably a pretty helpless feeling while you're waiting for those planes to come in and just watching this battle rage in the sky. I mean, could you guys see the bombers and see O'Hare and the fighters?
We could see them when they first came over and dropped the bombs. We could see them coming down. But when O'Hara and the other fellows actually chasing them, they were out of sight.
So what did you guys do while that was going on? I mean, I'm trying to imagine what you could do. You have to be pretty concerned about your ship's future here.
We probably were a little scared, really. I mean, we were up in their territory quite a bit, and here twin-engine bombers coming out after us. And like I say, we turned around and hauled out of there. It's kind of a helpless feeling when you are attacked. There's not much you can do. I mean, our duties there was in the after deck of the planes that would be landing and the resting gear. Oh, we had trained on the guns at different times and everything, but they had all those manned from the gunnery department and everything.
And it's not like you can do anything about it. You can't take cover anywhere. You've got to stay there on the deck ready to do your job, right?
That's right. There's not much you can do. And it's really a kind of a helpless feeling.
You mentioned them chasing those bombers, and they're flying F-4Fs at the time?
F-4Fs. Actually, F-4Fs was like a bumblebee. They were a very short wingspan, not much in length. They had so much torque that when they would take off down the deck, they would just move sideways. The change in aviation from the planes that we had then and what got later and then even throughout later in the war, too, were just unbelievable.
There was quite an advancement over time, and of course that's even more pronounced now, 76 years after the Lexington sank in the Coral Sea. One of the photos sent back by Paul Allen's RV Petrel crew shows one of those bumblebee-like F-4F fighters resting 2 miles below the surface. You can check that out at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear about the day that ship sank from Gordon Scott when we come right back after this.